This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. West Virginia's House approved a 5% pay raise negotiated by Governor Jim Justice to end a walkout by West Virginia teachers. Those schools in all of its 55 counties plan to stay closed today. House approval, 98-1 of the proposed raise, came Wednesday evening. The Senate, which had adjourned earlier, was expected to consider it today. Its leader, President Mitch Carmichael, expressed skepticism about the governor's suddenly higher projected tax increases that would pay for the pay boosts, but says that chamber would review it. Hundreds of teachers gathered inside the Capitol on Wednesday protesting low pay and projected increases in their insurance costs and chanted, "We won't back down." Others held a sign targeting legislators in the upcoming primary, "Make 'em pay in May." They occupied the House galleries to watch the vote. Governor Jim Justice revised his revenue estimates for the next year, which allows for a 5% pay raise for teachers and state service personnel, but it's unclear if that will appease the thousands of state employees who have rallied at the Capitol recently and who are still concerned about ballooning insurance rates. On last night's episode of The Legislature Today, host Andrea Lanham spoke with Senate Finance Chairman Craig Blair about these issues. Here's an excerpt from that interview.
Now, the House is considering that 5% pay raise right now. But on the Senate side, we're going to be more deliberative about what we do with that. First of all, we're hearing from the teachers a lot that they're more concerned about the PEIA. And we are as well. Even though the PEIA is a great health care plan, and compared to the private sector, we're getting more bang for the buck. There are efficiencies that can be had in that, and we're looking at taking, instead, since the governor's increased the revenue estimates, I think it was $57 million, it actually makes getting the budget out a little bit easier from that standpoint. But if we dedicated that money towards the PEIA, and PEIA, let's keep in mind that it is fully funded here for the next 17 months. But we also realize that there's changes that need to be made. But we're going to use a deliberative approach on what we're going to do with this and how we're going to handle it. And we're also going to be gauging the teachers' reactions on when the House passes out that 5%. And whether, so far what we're seeing is that they're still saying, no, this is not acceptable. And PEIA is a great concern to them, and as it is to us as well.
Now, I do understand that you talked with the governor's chief of staff. Did he give you any direction of where to go with these pay raise bills?
Well, it doesn't work that way. What our discussion mainly was around was what was being done with the budget and improvements on handling that. Keep in mind that we're at this point in the session right now where the budget's our number one priority. I'm the new finance chair, but I've set goals for the committee, and the goals have been to run it as efficient a process as possible. We've done a very good job of that. We don't hold back. We manage the bills, but we're also been working behind the scenes on this budget. Now, with these new revenue estimates coming in, that's changing things on how we're working with the budget, and then we've got to look and see what path that we're going to be traveling here, whether it's going to be a 5% pay raise, whether we take these additional revenues and take and put those in towards the PEIA. I actually believe that most of the teachers out here, sure, they'd like to have a pay raise, but what they really like to have is that they want to know that their insurance is going to be stable and predictable into the future. There's several bills out here right now that put money towards PIA, whether it's the sports betting one or the surplus. We've been looking at all the different angles on being able to manage PIA. But we also need to keep in mind that there's a systemic problem with PIA. And when I say systemic, when we have the PIA based on income instead of based on risk, and not offering multiple plans and things like that. We've got to take a hard look at that. And that's not something that it's hard to do that in a 60-day session.
But and, will you look at a dedicated revenue stream and what might that look like?
Well, to see, if you have a dedicated revenue stream, just like what we're talking about here, this additional $57 million or any derivative of that, that goes towards the funding of the PEIA and that keeps the cost down. And if we can do it in such a way that you don't have that 80-20 match that you put it in behind, so then that goes into the reserve fund for them, then we're in pretty good shape from that standpoint. That's a big deal for PEIA, but we're not going to stop there.
But what about this task force that the governor has proposed? What is that going to look like, and do you think the teachers are going to support that?
Well, I would hope the teachers would support that. In fact, I don't know. I'm not versed enough to know what to say on that, except for as we move through, that task force won't take place, so to speak, during this legislative session. What will happen is afterwards we'll be getting things together. Maybe they're talking about a piece of legislation for that, but I find that, just to be redundant, we can actually go out here and get that work done together.
That was Senate Finance Chairman Craig Blair speaking with the legislature today host Andrea Lanham. To listen or watch the entire interview, visit our website, wvpublic.org. A water system in Kentucky on the verge of collapse could soon get much-needed improvements. Some Martin County, Kentucky residents were without water this winter in a crisis that put the spotlight on problems common throughout Appalachian coal country. Nearly $5 million in federal funding is now on the way. But as Benny Becker reports, it comes amid lingering questions about how local officials have managed the water system.
The water system has been a contentious issue for over a decade in Martin County, a community that has mined billions of dollars worth of coal, but has been left with crumbling infrastructure and a poverty rate of nearly 40%. As The Resource reported last January, residents have complained that their water is often contaminated and frequently shut off without warning. The county's top elected official, Judge Executive Kelly Callahan, said he thought the complaints were overblown.
Do we have problems with the water system? We do. But not one time have you seen Martin County out of water for several weeks at a time. It won't happen. We have too good a system for that.
This past winter, the county's water intake froze and neighboring districts weren't able to provide extra water. So some sections of Martin County had their water cut off every day for over a week. Many were forced to draw water from creeks and springs to be able to drink, bathe, and flush their toilets. You can imagine this brought out some anger. At one public meeting, Martin County resident Gary Hunt was grabbed by the throat and arrested after using a cuss word as he expressed his frustration.
I asked for 275 L. You used it wrong. That's disorderly conduct. Come on.
That incident was captured by local TV station EKB News. It quickly went viral and brought a whole new wave of media coverage. That attention has helped Martin County to find funding. The water district has now been awarded nearly $5 million in federal grants in the last year, including $3.4 million announced this past weekend from Kentucky's portion of the Abandoned Mineland Fund. Meanwhile, many of the people responsible for the water district have resigned. The water district is currently under investigation by the Public Service Commission for the third time in 15 years. At a recent hearing, Commissioner Michael Schmidt had this to say about the Martin County Water District.
This is by far the worst water district, in my opinion, in the state of Kentucky. Worst run.
Martin County has a long history of struggling to find reliable leadership. A number of the county's elected officials have faced charges for embezzlement over the years. Denise Thomas of the Big Sandy Area Development District helped to write the Water District's grant proposal. She says it hasn't yet been determined who will manage the newly awarded funds, but her office will definitely remain involved. Thomas also works with utilities in neighboring counties, and she says that many of them are in a similar situation.
Keeping the utility system running, it's a challenge for all of our rural communities.
Gail Bryan, a water system expert and professor at the University of Kentucky, says this fits into a pattern that can be seen in many marginalized areas.
Here's a community that can't afford to replace their infrastructure, but they're ignored until something large and catastrophic happens.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker in Whitesburg, Kentucky, where my water was just cut off yesterday.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Last week's episode of Inside Appalachia features a story about racial integration in Mount Hope, West Virginia. In this community, the high school football team won the state championship in 1959, the year the school was integrated. One of the producers of the documentary was a football player himself at Mount Hope. His name is Jack Spadaro, and he told Inside Appalachia's Roxy Todd about why he wanted to help tell the story of his community's experience during desegregation.
How did your memories compare with what you were hearing from other people through this oral history project?
Well, you know, my memories were from the perspective of a young white person during that time. And when I began hearing the stories of my African-American friends who had played alongside me all those years, I found that the story was even richer than I remembered it. And also, I found that there were, even though by my account, there were pretty much good times, there were sometimes still encounters by black students with the old ways of segregation. They still had to, into the mid-60s, had to endure a segregated housing in the public housing areas. That didn't change until mid-60s, I think. Until, I think, the early 60s, the theaters were still segregated. The black kids had to go upstairs in a balcony. And another friend of mine reported and told me about this. Her name is Brenda Hyman, and she's going to be with us at a conference in Cincinnati in April. And Brenda said, we talked recently about how much fun we all had together and our friendships, but she also pointed out to me that there was still a separation. You know, we would all go to band practice or football practice or track practice or basketball practice together, but after that, there was still a separation in the communities, which was the leftover segregation from an earlier generation. So what I heard in the interviews about football just deepened my appreciation for what we were able to do as students and get beyond some of the barriers that had been set up before we were there.
And as far as what you decided to do, of course, you know, the media has done a lot of stories where outside journalists have come in, done a story, and left. But this is quite a different story. This is, you know, you worked with some oral historians, Michael and Carrie Klein, to collect long oral history interviews over a long period of time to get a really rich sense of the history and get a really rich sense of the story. Why did you choose to go about that method of doing the oral histories and, in a way, involving the community in telling their own story?
Well, I thought, well, there were two things. I wanted to get to the truth of the matter because I knew that because I was white, my perceptions would probably be a little rosier than my black classmates, okay? The other was I knew Michael and Carrie's work, and I knew that they have a really unique way of interviewing people where they don't really interject themselves that much into the conversation. And they let people tell their stories, and that reveals really so many layers that often have been forgotten or placed aside. And that's what we got. We have over 40 interviews that are so rich with all kinds of things that people remember and want to say now. And that has made this story far more meaningful even than I anticipated it to be, because it's shown, and it's especially in some of my friends like Charles McKinney, who is one of our leaders and is the guy who started Mountain of Hope several years ago, this abundant love. It's remarkable. And this understanding, and what I didn't know, for instance, Charles's entire history, and I found out as a child he had played with three or four of the white boys I grew up with, but he had started playing with them, I think, even before school. And he says in one of the interviews, and he's talking about how we played football together and how we protected each other, how each of us had a different area of the field we were responsible for. And he says toward the end of his interview, look, we loved each other, and that's the truth.
That was Jack Spadaro speaking with Roxy Todd. You can hear excerpts from that Mount Hope documentary Spadaro helped produce on last weekend's episode of Inside Appalachia on wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.